This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley.
You know, we want to hit the ground running. You know, I'm sworn in at 12:01 a.m., and you're going to see shortly after that a couple of executive orders to get us moving.
On Monday, Mike DeWine, who you just heard, and John Husted will be sworn in as governor and lieutenant governor of Ohio. They want immediate change and have ready multiple executive orders. What are their priorities? What role will John Husted play in the new administration? And what are the long-term implications of Republican Larry Householder forming an alliance with minority Democrats to secure the speakership in the Ohio House? To explore what might be ahead for Ohio, we are joined today by Cincinnati Enquirer Ohio government reporter Jesse Balmer, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. To join the discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everyone, to Cincinnati Edition on a Friday. Good to have you.
Thank you, sir.
Hey.
And, Jesse, you know, let's go back to the beginning of the week in the Ohio House. Larry Householder became the new speaker. He's a familiar name, at least for people who have been following Ohio politics for some time. The Republicans have a solid majority, 61-38, in that House. But Householder had to win his seat win his role as speaker by depending on 26 Democratic votes. What does this say about the state of both parties in Ohio?
Well, I think it shows some divisions in both House Republicans and House Democrats. Obviously, Larry Householder had fewer votes than Ryan Smith, the former speaker now, did within the Republican caucus. But he picked up 26 votes from Democrats, and that means that there were 12 Democrats who picked Ryan Smith. So Larry Householder ultimately ended up winning the speaker vote with 26 Republicans and 26 Democrats. And in one regard, you know, that looks nice, bipartisan speakership support from both sides, and perhaps an encouraging sign for Democrats going forward that they might have more of a say in the state house. But it is going to be challenging. A lot of Householder supporters are the most conservative members of the Ohio House and the most liberal members of the Ohio House. So what bills they're going to agree on that you can kind of get moving going forward is going to be interesting.
Well, Andy, what do you think the Democrats who supported Householder, what do you think they got out of this?
Well, it was all about labor issues. They went to the negotiation table and they heard what Householder would offer Democrats, and they heard what Ryan Smith would offer Democrats. And what they came out with, at least the people who said that they were in on the negotiations and the Democrats who voted for Householder, they say that they had a promise from Householder that he wasn't going to attack labor issues. So, for example, right to work, which would restrict people from creating unions. He's not going to touch that issue. They say that he's not going to touch a lot of the big labor issues. And so you could see in the House chamber during the House vote, during the speaker vote, you could see a lot of these lobbyists who represent labor groups walking around, pacing around, trying to make sure that, you know, these certain members voted the way that they wanted to vote. And again, all those labor groups were kind of huddled together outside of the chamber celebrating. They're very excited. I talked to one of them and they said that this is a big issue to make sure that something like SB 5, which if you remember from 2011, which would hurt collective bargaining agreements, they don't want to see anything like that happen again. They don't want anybody to touch things like prevailing wage and to hurt labor contracts. So it was all about labor when it came down to this issue.
Howard, what do you think about the durability of those sorts of agreements?
Well, I think obviously right to work is the big one. You know, that's the one they're most concerned about. These kind of agreements are not written in blood. Okay, they're agreements among politicians, and I think in the beginning it'll probably work out fine. But over a period of time, I just can't see that holding together. Now, it might end up in like the next in the next election, the 2020 election, that it makes it a little easier for Democrats to pick up some seats in the House.
Because
they're getting things that constituents want.
Okay. So it's around these labor issues that are critical. You know, Larry Householder is himself, on a personal level, you know, sort of an explosive person in the history of the House. He's been gone for a while. He's back. What, you know, how does he play with how does he play with not just the other Republican members of the House, but also the new Republican administration, which we'll be talking about here?
Yeah, I think I know what you're asking, Dan, because, I mean, I wasn't around when Larry Householder was Speaker the last time around, but I've heard plenty of stories. But any time that I've interacted with him, although, I mean, he's been kind of quiet. He's been trying to keep a low profile for the most part for the past 2 years. But, you know, he talked to reporters the other day, his presence up on the dais in the House chamber. He didn't seem to be an explosive character the way that we've heard stories of it. And he has said that he's a changed person from, you know, the early aughts. So I think he is trying to sort of create a different sort of persona when it comes to the kind of person he's going to be. All that remains to be seen now that he is in the leadership role, now that he is in the speaker's chair. You know, maybe we're going to see those old tendencies again. It just remains to be seen.
I think what you're also going to see is he's going to have to shore up support among Republicans quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Just because right now he doesn't have the majority of his caucus behind him. And I think you could see that in committee assignments. I think you could see that in the budget, who gets access or, you know, might get some money for their district or projects or so forth. So when you have the speaker's gavel, you have a lot of power to, you know, make sure people are rewarded for loyalty or, you know, perhaps brought back into the fold. So I think you'll see that pretty quickly.
Or give Democrats some authority. Give those Democrats some actual authorities to be able to get some things done.
Well, one of the things he promised was to hire sort of a human relations person in the House. Am I right? What does that mean?
He wants to put a head of human resources in the Ohio House. And I think what that's trying to do is to address some of these issues when it comes to harassment and discrimination claims. I mean, just hours before he was elected as Speaker, a complaint from a House staffer was brought to light. And that staffer was complaining about Householder supporters. So I think he mentioned that because there have been issues when it comes to harassment and discrimination claims. And so he just wants to assign one person to sort of shore that up and lead that effort.
What are Householders? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jesse.
Oh, there's been a number of lawmakers who have resigned from both the House and the Senate in recent years. One in the Senate because of sexual harassment and another because of inappropriate behavior in his office. And I think a lot of aides and staffers in the House don't really feel like they can bring their concerns about allegations to the people who maybe are their bosses or overseeing them. And so having like an outside HR professional from maybe business or, you know, another outside of the politics, having somebody outside that, I think is something that a lot of people would say is needed in the House. It was something they started to address before Cliff Rosenberger, the former speaker, resigned, but that kind of went by the wayside when he was leaving via a FBI probe.
What's Householder's relationship to Mike DeWine?
He says that he's known DeWine for many, many years, that he's a good friend and that they've been able to work together in the past. I do think that this does create an interesting dynamic in the Ohio legislature. I think if you were to ask the DeWine administration, the incoming DeWine administration, candidly, I think they would tell you that they were probably expecting Ryan Smith to be the speaker, with which they have had a good relationship with them. So I think that this does throw them for a loop a little bit. But I mean, I think that because DeWine and Householder have known each other for a while, I don't know if it really throws a huge curveball in their plans.
Okay. What do we know about Mike DeWine? You know, we played that soundbite that he wants to get started right away. Has said that he has some executive orders ready to go. What do we know about Mike DeWine's immediate plans?
So our bureau chief, Karen Kassler, got to talk to Mike DeWine yesterday, and he talked about how he does have the pen ready and he does have a couple of EOs ready to go. He would not go into any specifics, though. It's hard to tell. I think anytime a new governor comes in, I think they do sort of have their idea of what they want to create right away. Everybody sort of has their own agenda in mind. So I don't really want to guess or speculate too much. But what I will say is that DeWine's made it clear that one of his number one issues has been to protect and serve Ohio children. He really wants to start addressing issues when it comes to foster care and early childhood education and intervention services. So maybe that might be something he has in mind. He's creating a new Office of Children's Initiatives. Again, he has declined to go into specifics about exactly what executive orders he wants to sign.
Ohio will officially swear in a new governor into office on Monday. What changes can we expect? To discuss that, we are joined by Cincinnati Enquirer government reporter Jesse Ballmer, by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, and by WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. To join our conversation, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Howard, you know, when we talk about differences between Mike DeWine and John Kasich, should we be looking at John Kasich in his first term, because this is Mike DeWine's first term? Should we be looking at John DeWine, John Kasich in his second term? How should we be looking at the differences that might be drawn?
I don't know. I mean, the first term obviously was full of all kinds of surprises with the Medicaid expansion and you know, those kind of issues, and taking away the local government fund money and the state tax, and just infuriating local governments. Now, that is something that probably, I know Mike DeWine might be able, with the help of the legislature, to at least fix a part of that problem. I don't think it's ever going to be restored to any great extent. But I think as far as the second term of John Kasich, you can write that off. I mean, let's just write it off, because it didn't happen. It was a presidential run for the nomination, which ended up in disaster. And with a Donald Trump being nominated in Cleveland, Ohio, and John Kasich refusing to even walk into the Quicken Loan Center to acknowledge that there was a convention going on in his own state.
Yeah.
So I think you can write that off. I mean, you look at what he did in terms of policy in his first term, and then compare that to what Mike DeWine might do, or might policies that he might change. You know, he's talked about the Medicaid expansion and maybe tweaking that, as he says.
Jesse, I heard you reacting a little bit there.
Sorry, that was me.
That was you, Andy.
Okay. Sorry, I think the thing that gets me laughing is, I mean, I think Howard's right. I mean, Kasich did do many things in his second term that are notable as governor of Ohio, but he was a very, very different governor from the first term, compared from the first term to the second term. I mean, for the first term, everybody would tell you that he did things very differently. He really was forceful and aggressive in trying to get policy through in the legislature. He had his staff in all of the committee meetings, really pushing for big things. He started doing MBRs, the mid-biennium reviews. So where he had his budget, where he would push through a lot of policies on different things. He also had the MBR on the off-budget years, where he would also push a lot of policy through. So there was a very aggressive take on policy in the first term that you didn't see as much in the second term.
He was very engaged in the first term, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But not so much in the second term.
Well, Jesse, do you pick up any hint of Mike DeWine being interested, willing to sort of pull back some of the policies that took resources away from local governments? Because that affected Republican-controlled and Democratic-controlled local governments. And that is just a sore point with a lot of people running cities and townships and all sorts of schools, all sorts of units.
Yeah, so I spoke with Mayor John Cranley about this a little bit, and he was saying they sat down, the Ohio Mayors Alliance, which is a group of bipartisan mayors, with DeWine and Lieutenant Governor Husted to talk about just how they can work with cities moving forward. And Cranley's first advice was, like, do no harm. Like, if you just leave us alone, that would be great. If you want to actually help, that would be lovely as well. But the first thing they wanted was kind of a stop on the attacks on local control and home rule, and kind of allowing them to run their cities as they see fit. And I do think Mike DeWine has been receptive to that throughout the campaign and has talked a lot about working with local government. He started in local government as a county prosecutor. And so I think he has a desire to look at that. But I don't know if there's going to be the money in the budget for reforming all of children's services and reforming all of local government funds. So I think cities and folks at the local level are excited that he is going to be a partner as opposed to, you know, the way John Kasich approached things. But I don't think anyone is expecting a full return of all the money.
Oh, I don't think anybody's expecting that, no.
And I don't think, like, the estate tax that was eliminated, I don't see that returning.
That's not coming back. But, no, the one thing that, you know, Jesse mentioned, the Ohio Mayors Alliance, which met in December with DeWine and Husted. And what you have to remember about that group is it's the mayors of the 30 largest cities in Ohio, except for Cleveland. Cleveland's mayor didn't want any part of it. And there are 20 Democrats and 10 Republicans. It's a bipartisan group, and they are going to be there basically lobbying for the cities. And they all hire lobbyists, or most of them do anyway. But these are mayors who are willing to go do it themselves personally. And they've established the relationships with the DeWine administration, with DeWine himself, and with Husted, who has political ambitions too.
And that's also a change, too.
Yeah.
The cities have become much more engaged and realize that they need to have a voice in Columbus when these decisions are being made, and before they really didn't.
And this is a bipartisan group, too.
If you look at the issue of local government funding, I mean, that's a pot of money that's been reduced over the years. But when you talk to the Mayor's Alliance and you talk to the County Commissioners Association, they say the thing that's really hurting are just this loss of revenue for certain services that are much needed on the local level. So when it comes to drug addiction services, when it comes to early childhood education services or education in general. And so while DeWine has not really made a promise to pump money into the local government fund, those things that I just mentioned, early childhood education, and drug prevention and addiction services,
sure.
Those are things that he does want to focus on. And those are things where I think you might see a lot of attention put towards during the budget.
Well, let me.
Yeah, and he said just this week that Ohio is 50th in the money that goes to public children's services, and he says that'll change in the budget. So,
okay, let me get on before we run out of time. I want to get on to another topic, and that is the role of John Husted. Here was somebody who wanted to run for governor himself, started a campaign, then pulled out, agreed to run as the running mate for Mike DeWine. What's his role going to be as the administration starts? I don't care. Andy, yeah. Jesse, whichever one.
He is going to lead a new office within the governor's administration called Innovate Ohio. And the big thing about this office is that it's going to utilize technology to fill in the blank. And then that fill in the blank is the stuff that we're still kind of waiting to see. I think Husted and his office does have very specific details of what they want to do. But in short, they want to utilize technology to improve customer services, to improve the experience that Ohioans have when they are working with a state agency. I got to talk to Husted a couple of days ago on this issue, and he says, for example, you know, when you go to the BMV, that's a state agency, and you're trying to get a service through that agency, how can technology improve that? Maybe can you do more things through online portals? For veteran services, how can you improve those services through web-based technology? So there's all sorts of things that I think he has in mind. He just hasn't shared everything. But it's really this idea of this office, Innovate Ohio, going into all the other state agencies and finding ways to really streamline services using certain technologies to improve the process.
Howard, how do you see the relationship between John Husted and Mike DeWine?
Actually, I think it's a pretty good relationship. But one thing you got to remember about John Husted is that he has not abandoned his dream of becoming governor of the state of Ohio someday. And I think he would like to follow Mike DeWine into office. You know, it's hard to say. I don't know if Mike DeWine's going to run for a second term. He's 72 years old now. He'd be 76 then. He'd be 80 at the end of a second term. When John Husted came into that, got out of the governor's race, turned over a whole lot of money to Mike DeWine's campaign, and really wrapped up the nomination for him.
Right. So he may owe him something.
He may owe him something.
Well, I want to thank Andy, Jesse, and Howard for being here today. And let's be very respectful of people who are 72.
Absolutely.
All right. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. 16,000 students will return to class this Monday at Wright State University in Dayton. But a dark cloud hangs over the campus. The bargaining unit of the faculty, the AAUP, the American Association for University Professors, has filed formal notice that it is prepared to strike beginning at 8 a.m. Tuesday, January the 22nd. What is the likelihood of a settlement before the deadline? What happens if negotiations fail? To discuss what is going on at Wright State, we are joined by the Ohio Higher Education Reporter for the Cox Media Group, which includes the Dayton Daily News, WHIO-TV and radio, Max Philby. You can join our discussion by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Max, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Just to get started here, what are the issues that divide the AAUP and the university administration at Wright State?
Sure. So there's a number of issues that are kind of being debated right now. One of them being a lot of changes to healthcare plans. And then when it comes to the faculty, they're making a big issue and looking at workload. This new furlough policy, which would basically allow the university to furlough its faculty for a few days a semester in order to save some money.
What would that mean?
How would that big issues?
How would that work? How would this furlough? Reading about this, I'm just not clear. When you've got a full-time faculty who's teaching a class that's maybe meets Monday, Wednesday, Friday, how does a furlough work in this situation?
Sure. So the university administration has told me that basically they would target days where students typically aren't on campus. So say like the day before Thanksgiving, that Wednesday, there actually aren't any classes scheduled, even though faculty's still there, or perhaps a day over spring break as well.
Oh, okay. Well, there's that kind of stuff. Okay.
Sure.
So how long has this negotiation been going on? I mean, it's obviously the AAUP filed formal notice that it's ready to strike and start picketing, but this is at the end of a process. How long has this been going on?
Right. So this has been going on for nearly 2 years now. They've been going back and forth for that whole time. And then just within the last about a week or so now was when this all started to bubble to the surface, that the administration at the university implemented its last best offer to the union. And then this past Monday, the union filed a notice with the State Employment Relations Board that they were planning to strike on the 22nd. So we've been following this a long time. And this is kind of the culmination of 2 years of talks that haven't gone as well as I think they'd hoped.
So how many faculty members are members of the AAUP, and how many other faculty members are there, either, you know, full-time who aren't members of the bargaining unit or who are part-time faculty?
Sure. So the bargaining unit represents around 560 faculty members there. Altogether, there's about 1,700 faculty members at Wright State. So I think, at least for now, the plan is, as the university has said, to basically try to keep classes going if a strike does happen, and just staff them with other faculty members. Some members of the administration, including the president, have even said that they would maybe sub in for a class if they had to.
Well, you know, that all sounds great. I've been both a high school and a university professor. And in high school, you know, you can send me off for a day and I can take care of the chemistry class so that it at least doesn't blow itself up. But in a university level, I'm a historian by background. You can't send me into the physics class. I can't do a thing. I'm useless. I mean, that I don't know how that works.
Right. And that's kind of what the union has said, that the union has complained that essentially what the university would be doing is just sticking a body in the room, and that they might not necessarily be qualified to teach the certain level of class that they're staffing during a strike and whatnot. So there's been a lot of debate about that. And yeah.
Well, you know, if I'm a student and I'm seeing this sort of coming down the pike, and the semester is going to start on Monday, and that classes may be functionally sort of suspended the following Tuesday, I may be tempted not to start that semester and save my money. What does this mean for enrollment, for income at the university? This could be a real blow.
Sure. So the university, as I'm sure you're aware, has gone through some serious financial difficulties over the last few years. Just last year, they reduced spending by about $53 million in order to meet budget. So essentially, this strike, there are definitely some concerns that the administration has expressed that it could cause enrollment to drop. The university's already had some enrollment issues retaining students during some of these financial issues. So, you know, and if enrollment drops more from this strike, that would result in fewer tuition dollars coming in and potentially more financial trouble for the university.
You could start a really nasty spiral in the long run here.
Correct.
I can see where this is a real, real challenge. Well, thank you for joining us today and sort of catching up our audience on what's happening just to the north. And I'm sure that we have students in our listening area, particularly on the north side, who attend Wright State. So we're going to, we'll have to keep up with this and maybe have you back. So thank you very much, Max Philby.
No problem, Dan. Take care.
Last year, things turned ugly when St. Xavier basketball squad traveled to play the Elder Panthers. After that night, both schools took steps to address the implicit and explicit issues that fueled the confrontation. Tonight, Xavier travels again to the Pit at Elder High School. Joining us now is WVXU reporter Ann Thompson.
Hi, Dan.
How you doing, Ann?
Oh, fine, thank you.
So what have the two schools, or I think, as I understand it, maybe more properly, the four GCL South schools, what have they been doing in this past year to try to address the issues that became very public this time last year?
Sure. So in a series of meetings involving both administrators and students, they've just been talking out like what's an appropriate cheer and what isn't. Now, you might think that's kind of obvious, but as the Elder Athletic Director, Kevin Espelidge, told me in an interview, there were some cheers in other games involving like Fortnite, and he had no idea what everybody was talking about. And just
generational split here.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's right. And so just to, you know, talk about racial sensitivity and cheering and kind of a common sense thing that has taken place also is normally the field house is very crowded where they play the St. X basketball games. And so they've made room for cheerleaders where they really haven't had that before. So just like students with megaphones like they have at the football games, and they will be kind of controlling the message, I guess you could say. So
my understanding from what you filed, the story you filed on our website here at WVXU, is that the only cheers will be those led by
right. I think that's the idea.
The cheerleaders.
They'll be sitting right down front, and yes, that is
cleared
true.
Out.
Yes.
They've cleared out the first row.
Now, right after the game last year, the school elder did take a series of steps. The principal actually was out of town, and due to some cell phone reception, didn't really hear about it for a while, didn't get back to, I think, a parent until Monday. But, clearly St. X parents were upset, especially the parents of the two students, basketball players who were targeted. And Cincinnati Archbishop Dennis Schnurr said he was deeply dismayed by what happened. And so Elder's principal had students go over to St. X and apologize. And there was a letter that was written by the athletic director of Elder apologizing to the St. X parents. But yes, you're right that there's been a series of meetings in the GCL to try to prevent this in the future.
Well, as you talk to the principal or the athletic director, did you get the impression that the goal here of these talks was to make sure that something didn't happen at sporting events, which can be pretty confrontational?
Yes, of course. Uh-huh.
Or did it go beyond that? Is it deeper than that, that the steps that they've taken? Have they tried to deal with the underlying issues of implicit and explicit bias?
Yes, I think that it goes beyond the games. I think that would be the goal. And they wanted to make sure that we understood that students were involved as well, and they're taking this very seriously. And it's not just Elder and St. X, it's the GCL schools, including Moeller and LaSalle, and they're all just trying to, take it a step further so it's beyond just the games.
So what do you sense is the mood going into this game of when Xavier goes back almost a year later? That happened a couple weeks after, but we're just short of a year later, going back to Elder to play this game. These are big rivalries.
Yes. Well, I didn't exactly ask that question of the principal and the athletic director, but if I was in their place, I would be a little nervous because, they've taken all these steps, and I'm sure that, the St. X parents, and I'm not sure if the two, I didn't know what year the two kids were, so I'm not sure if they're still on the team, but yeah, I think they would probably be a little bit nervous, but given these steps that they've taken, let's hope that things go the right way.
One of the things about this incident is that it came on the tail end of incidents in Mason schools and also in King's district. And then this incident took place. And I went back and listened to the show that we did, and I wasn't here yet, that we did on Cincinnati Edition a week after this occurred, and the principal from Elder was on, and a number of people were on, and the challenge was, are we going to use this in the community, not just in the schools, but in the community, as a teaching moment, in effect, where mm-hmm. we are going to commit ourselves to going deeper on these issues of race and class and culture and all those things. And it's very interesting to think about that in relationship to all the issues that we've had in this community in the past year, which they just seem to get harder.
It's true. That's right. Yes. Well, at least in the high school setting, hopefully it's maybe getting better given these meetings that they're continuing to have.
Do you know who the cheerleaders are? Are these going to be male cheerleaders from Elder or are Seton?
They're actually going to be male cheerleaders from Elder. I asked that specifically.
Yeah, because that may have – they have a little bit more.
Right, yes.
And did they review what the permissible cheers were?
Well, I didn't ask that, but I'm sure that they have.
Yeah, they've right. gone over that. They probably had some meetings and communications with the entire student body.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting reminder that this is just a year since that incident, and it's great that you went back and talked to them, and I'm sure everybody's going to be watching. And
tip-off is at 7:30 tonight.
Yeah, hopefully the focus is on the basketball game and the score and what the dynamics of the game are, and not all the stuff that maybe surrounds that.
Correct.
So, and thank you for being here today.
You're welcome.
Last Friday night, Coleraine police officer Dale Woods was struck and killed while on duty directing traffic at the scene of an earlier crash. He'll be remembered this weekend in a series of ceremonies before being laid to rest on Monday. We are joined now by WCPO reporter and anchor Evan Millward. Evan,
hey.
Thank you for joining us today, just in time.
Yeah,
this is what I love.
Good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. So remind us of what happened last Friday night in with Dale Wood and in this situation.
Yeah, boy, this is a tough one, isn't it? So, you know, Officer Woods was doing his job. He was out. There was a car crash out there on Coleraine. Car hit a light pole, took out the light pole. We have since learned the driver admitted to being on acid in that crash. So if you're looking for kind of the nugget of information there of what went down here, because that'll lead to something here a little bit later. So by all accounts, Officer Woods was then out kind of on traffic duty, and he was moving a cone to make sure everything was secure at that scene and make sure everyone there was safe. And that's the sad irony of this, when he was hit by a pickup truck. And we kind of know how that played out from there. He was very, very, very hurt. And we talked to people on the scene that night who said they were watching people do chest compressions on him on scene before they even transported him. And people who were there and saw it happen didn't have a good feeling about how this was going to go. But if it's any indication, I mean, the guy's a fighter. And he fought until Monday night.
Yeah, and then died. Who was Dale Wood? Talk to us a little bit about what you've found out about Mr. Wood and his long service in Coleraine.
I think that right there. If you're a numbers person, kind of like me, where you like the empirical data of things. He spent 30 of his 46 years on this earth in public service in a professional capacity. He spent 15 some years as a firefighter paramedic. He did some time as a Hamilton County dispatcher. And then he spent almost 15 years with Coleraine Police. And I don't know if that tells you something about a man. 30 of 46 years in public service is something to honor and celebrate, which... And in this case, mourn, too. That community is losing someone. You know, on Tuesday, I kind of went out with the goal to find people he had touched. We had heard a lot from the brothers and sisters in blue. But I was like, I know this man touched people. And we actually went back and had found he had pulled a woman in Coleraine, kind of off Pippin Road, an apartment there in September, had pulled her from her apartment. Her dryer was on fire. And her apartment was filling with smoke, and she's blind. And so they get in, and they go to the apartment where the 911 call had come from and realize that she's still in there. And he pulled her out, and it's all on body camera video. And we had played it, I think, the day after, but went back, and I went back and talked to her. And she said, you could feel love coming from his voice because he was so gentle and so kind in what is a very chaotic situation for her. So that's one story. Then we had another story of a family on Deschler Drive in Coleraine Township where a mom there had posted a bunch of pictures Monday night of Officer Woods out throwing the football with a bunch of the rugrats on the street. And it had happened right after the kids all went back to school one evening. And she said, going back months before that even, her daughter had come in the house one day with candy and said, and mom was like, wait, who gave you this candy? And the daughter said it was an officer. And she went out and met Officer Woods. And he would just occasionally swing back by that neighborhood. Hmm. And he would bring candy for the kids, and he'd play the football with the kids. And those are just two stories. And those are just the two that I went out and found in a couple hours on Tuesday. And I know there's more, right? I've seen some things Twitter and Facebook, people talking about their interactions with him or who worked with him at the dispatch center, by all accounts. And I think Chief Mark Denny said it too. He was a cop's cop, but he was someone who grew up in Coleraine Township and North College Hill, and he wanted to be there to do the best he could for his community.
So this was somebody who was embedded in the community, not just as a public servant, but also somebody who had grown up there, whose roots were there. So it's pretty deep what's going on. How?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a certain level of loyalty, right? So you want to do the best you can in your hometown.
How has the police department reacted to this? And have they lost, has Coleraine Township lost police officers in the past?
Coleraine Township in modern history has not lost an officer in the line of duty like this. Mm-hmm. The fire department has, and that's in recent history, lost two.
Where the floor Chief fell Mark through. Denny,
yeah. Right. Right. When Chief Mark Denny came out Monday night and announced Officer Wood's death, you could tell it had knocked him back a good amount. Saturday, we were told he hadn't left Dale's side Saturday. And I think that's probably very true on Sunday, too. We did see him on Sunday. He came out and gave a brief little update outside the hospital. But this is a position that I can't fathom being in. If you were a police chief, is how do you hold a department together and you can't stop? You know, even on Monday and through the weekend, really, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, there are memorials for him. But you still also have a job to do, and you get help from outside agencies. But it's a unique position in that the police and the fire departments can't stop and mourn when something like this happens, because you're still on call. You're still getting 911 calls. So for how Chief Denny has been able to juggle this is impressive, and they've had a lot of help.
Well, you know,
and a lot of support.
Coleraine Township is the most populous township in the state of Ohio, and if it was a city, it would be one of the largest. How large is the police department?
You know what? I don't actually know. I don't have a number on that off the top of my head. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's fine.
But it's certainly not Cincinnati big, but they are sizable.
So what, you know, you're talking about the reaction of fellow officers. And by the way, I think from, we could also say, members of the fire service, where he had served as well. But what about just, you know, the people you found, those two people that you wanted to talk, you got to talk to, you found in the community. How's the community going to mark this death, especially this weekend, as, you know, lots of remembrances and it's the opportunity to sort of recognize Officer Woods?
You know, it started immediately while he was still in the hospital. Saturday morning, someone came and just dropped a large bouquet of flowers outside. Coleraine Township Police have they call it the Community Resource Center right there on Coleraine. It's around the corner from where the crash happened. That was there. People started tying blue ribbons around anything that you could tie a blue ribbon around. Up and down Coleraine Avenue, outside of the community center and the police department, there on Springdale. And now we have these plans through the weekend, and it'll be interesting to see how this winter weather affects this. There's a procession plan Saturday, kind of right in the midst of what, at least, you know, our folks, the 9-1-1 warning weather team, thinks might be kind of the worst of this winter storm. But there's a procession plan, and then there's a public visitation at Coleraine High School at noon on Saturday. I'm willing to bet that the township will more or less be shut down because of how many people want to be there. And then there's some private visitations and memorials on Sunday at Spring Grove Cemetery. And then we've got the public memorial service on Monday at the Cintas Center at noon.
That's on Xavier University's campus.
Yeah. And that's Shades of Sonny Kim with Cincinnati Police Department there. Much like Sonny Kim, I would expect that thing to be almost full. This community is pretty well known for their support of public servants. We do it big here in our area.
What about you raised the point about the driver early on being on on acid? What do we know about the driver of that truck and his situation at this point?
Well, so the driver on acid is the one who caused the initial crash, hit the light pole, and that's why Dale Woods responded. What we don't know much at all about is the driver of the pickup truck that hit him. Other than they are cooperating, and this has been handed over to Cincinnati police so that Coleraine Township doesn't have to investigate the circumstances around the death of one of their own. Cincinnati police agreed to step in, and I actually, within probably the last hour, reached out to some folks at CPD just to, hey, is there any kind of update? And they know because I was hitting them up over the weekend going, why are we not giving us more about this? This man hit and potentially killed and then eventually, yeah, is responsible for the death of a police officer. Why are we not making a bigger deal about this? And that is still unanswered at this point. It's the response I got here in the last hour was it is still an active investigation, nothing new to release. And so there are some conclusions you can draw there, but you know, I'll avoid speculation at any cost, you know, unfortunately or fortunately. So it was handled pretty quickly at the scene, and so we just don't have enough, even from our folks who were there that night. Luckily, this was not like a hit and run where we have no information about who this person is. Police know who it is. They're cooperating. It's just now a matter of sorting out what happened, I think.
So just to be clear here, there was an initial incident of someone hitting a pole, snapping the pole off, causing the situation.
And that person we know was admittedly under the influence. And they've been charged appropriately, as you would expect.
Okay.
And then there was a secondary crash.
Right, which actually hit Officer Woods. And has that person at this point hasn't even been charged. Is that correct?
Yeah, as far as we know, there's no charges. They've certainly not been identified. But they are cooperating, is what we keep being told.
So is that sort of, I know you don't want to speculate, but in these sorts of situations, does that possibly indicate that, this could have been truly an accident?
That would be my guess, is that this is, if we have not seen anyone charged and sort of publicly put on display, that to me would indicate a couple of things, and the fact that this might have just been a horribly tragic accident is my best guess.
Well, Evan Millward, thank you very much for being here today and catching us up on this tragic situation. And
yeah, I wish I could be here for something happier.
That's right.
Well,
I think we all do. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.